Good evening.
I was quite pleasantly surprised when I was asked to do this about Rosa Luxemburg. Not particularly. I really, honestly, would rather somebody else had done it, only for personal reasons, and we've got many people in the party who can do it quite well. But I was surprised to find that they tell me there's still considerable interest and that people had asked for this and that therefore we should do it, which, fair enough, is right enough. Voice of democracy and all that. However, whether she's still well remembered or not, there's not the slightest doubt, and I can reiterate what Rose has just said, another Rose, our Rose, that when you come to study and follow the activities of this person, this woman, you are dealing with a quite, I'm not talking now about politics or socialism or anything, you are dealing with a quite remarkable, almost a fantastic character. There's little doubt of this. She was a lyrical writer in her own right. I'm going to start off, as I frequently do, by reading you, because you're too lazy to do it for yourselves, some of the stuff that she wrote, for instance, at the beginning of the world, of the 1914 war. And this was one of the things that, when you listen to this sort of stuff, that put the fat in the fire and the cat among the pigeons. I think it was Lawrence, Conrad Lawrence, the naturalist, who said that when Charles Darwin discovered that men had descended from animals, they could have killed him. Well, in the case of Rosa Luxemburg, when she, in this pamphlet, called on the workers of Europe, and particularly the workers of Germany, to stop slaughtering each other and to unite to abolish capitalism, it wasn't a case of could. They did bloody well kill her and made sure that they'd done it too. Now, I'll read a little bit of this, and when you listen to this sort of stuff, you can imagine the effect that this could have on a tired and half-starved German working class on the one hand, and an insanely patriotic, militaristic capitalist class on the other. She started this was already in 1914. It was called the Junius Brochure because she wrote it from prison. That's another amazing thing about it. The entire German prison service, I'll just digress a little here, but it's true, the entire German prison service never discovered ways either of her getting books in or smuggling articles out. She wrote, the scene has thoroughly changed. This will tell you when it was written. This is the First World War. The 6 weeks' march to Paris has become a world drama. Mass murder has become a monotonous task. And yet the final solution is not one step nearer. Capitalist rule is caught in its own trap and cannot ban the spirit that it has invoked. Gone is the first mad delirium. Gone are the patriotic demonstrations, the chase after suspicious-looking automobiles. By the way, it's an American translation. The false telegrams, the cholera-poisoned wells. Gone the mad stories of Russian students who hurl bombs from every bridge in Berlin, or Frenchmen flying over Nuremberg. Gone are the excesses of a spy-hunting populace, the sinning throngs, the coffee shops with their patriotic songs. Gone the violent mobs ready to denounce, ready to persecute women, ready to whip themselves into a delirious frenzy over every wild rumour. Gone the atmosphere of ritual murder, the Kishinev air that left this policeman at the corner as the only remaining representative of human dignity. The show is over. The curtain has fallen on trains filled with reservists as they pull out amid the joyous cries of enthusiastic maidens. We no longer see their laughing faces, smiling cheerily from the train windows upon a war-mad population. Quietly they trot through the streets with their rucksacks on their shoulders, and the public, with a fretful face, goes about its daily task. Into the disillusioned atmosphere of pale daylight, there rings a different chorus, the hoarse croak of the hawks and hyenas of the battlefield. 10,000 tents guaranteed according to specification. 100,000 kilograms of bacon, cocoa powder, coffee substitute, all cash on immediate delivery, shrapnel, drills, ammunition, marriage bureaus for war widows, leather belts, war orders, only serious propositions considered, and the cannon fodder that was loaded upon the trains in August and September is rotting on the battlefields of Belgium and the Vosges, while the prophets are springing like weeds from the fields of the dead. That is magnificent writing. I wish we had a few like it and striking for the socialist standard. And incidentally, I might as well finish it now I've started it. I will come back to this, but in any case, the conclusion of the pamphlet, after investigating, and I would advise you to read it for yourself, after exposing mercilessly the whole frame-up of the trickery of the German government pretending that they were dragged into the war by Austria through its attack by Russia and all this rubbish, and after stating the case for internationalism, she finished the pamphlet by saying, Deutschland, Deutschland über alles, long live democracy, long live the Tsar and slavery, 10,000 tent cloths guaranteed according to specification, 100,000 pounds of bacon, coffee substitute, dividends arising and proletarians falling, and with each one there sinks a fighter of the future, a soldier of the revolution, a saviour of humanity from the yoke of capitalism into the grave. This madness will not stop, and this bloody nightmare of hell will not cease until the workers of Germany, of France, of Russia and of England wake up out of their drunken sleep, will clasp each other's hands in brotherhood, and will drown the bestial chorus of war agitators and the hoarse cry of capitalist hyenas with the mighty cry of labour. Workers of all countries, unite. That's the way to do it. No wonder they wouldn't stop until they'd finally physically exterminated her, because, of course, they'd tried several times putting her inside and it wasn't very successful. But I better go back to the end of it to give you a kind of a review of it and a chance to chew the fat. I mentioned that just to show you the calibre of the personality you're dealing with. But long, long before this, Rose gave you a short biographical outline of how it happened that she left Poland and went to Switzerland to study, the conditions in those days in Russian Poland making it impossible for a woman to undertake an academic career. In this case, she was like her sister Marie Curie, who went to study science in Paris for the same reason. Rosa sought to go to Switzerland, was extremely happy there, studied 3 years, did brilliantly, and at that time Switzerland, as you probably know, was a political hotbed for Eastern European clandestine revolutionaries. Plekhanov, Lenin, Martov, all of them were there, either in Zurich or in Lucerne, bound. And it was about this time, and this is some other thing that I would strongly recommend anybody who's interested in the party, and especially those who speak for it. This is by no means a waste of time. A man by the name of Eduard Bernstein, who enjoyed a very high reputation, and by the way, I might as well mention, we're on a trip to Germany, I hope you'll realise that, who had a very high reputation in the German Social Democratic Party. He'd been over here in London. He was a pupil of Marx, like Karl Liebknecht and Paul Lafargue. He lived in Engels' house up there in Regent's Park Road, which has still got the plate on it, he went back again to Germany, and he arrived back in Switzerland during the time of the anti-socialist laws, because Bismarck, quite mistakenly and unintelligently in a way, imagined that he could suppress the socialist movement by making it illegal. The only result of this was that it moved over to Switzerland, and as Engels wrote, the publications of the Social Democratic Party probably got a larger illegal circulation than a legal one, until it got to the point where there was no point in trying to suppress it any further. I mention this because the paper which was published and edited from Switzerland and smuggled quite easily into Germany was the paper Vorwärts, the famous, the Berlin organisation of the SPD considered it was their personal property. And when I come to the Spartacus revolt, I'll explain the meaning of that. But it was the central organ and the main mouthpiece of the so-called Vorstand, or the executive, the committee of the central committee of the party, and it was considered to be its authoritative mouthpiece. And this man Bernstein, he wasn't an academic by profession. He was originally a bank clerk, but he was quite a bright boy. And as I say, he was trained here in London by the old men. And went back again and rapidly became the editor of Vorwärts. Now, after he'd been back in Germany a short time, as you probably may know, at this time Germany was a country of a fantastic boom. It was the country, it was the time of the electrification and the railways and all the rest of it, and Germany enjoyed a tremendous economic booming. And it was at this time that this man Bernstein conceived this idea and wrote this this book called The Preconditions for the Establishment of Socialism. It was subsequently translated into English and published in this country, of course, by the Independent Labour Party. Who else? Who regarded it as gold dust for exactly. And Ramsay MacDonald, who subsequently became Prime Minister, wrote a book called Socialism, which was mainly cribbed from Bernstein. Now, very briefly, what Bernstein was trying to say, and you should read it for yourself, it's in English, evolutionary socialism. What he was trying to say was that, and incidentally, what made it even worse, he started off the book with a classical enumeration of the Marxian tenet. He said that we've always been given to understand that socialism is a historical process, that it will emanate from the progress of the class struggle, and he knew all this, he knew it all very well. Having stated that, he then went on to say that in his view the facts in Germany in particular, and in Britain and in Europe, had not confirmed this. One thing he contended was that there wasn't a growing polarisation of classes, that the Marxian theory that the capitalist class became numerically smaller but richer, and correspondingly many were forced down in the ranks of the workers, were not true. He produced what purported to be figures to prove this. He produced figures to show that the number of shareholders in German concerns had gone up, not down. Incidentally, Rosa Luxemburg wrote a brilliant reply to this and said that he didn't know the difference between a shareholder and a capitalist, but I can't... You should read it. Now, but the main thing was that from this, from all this, and also he cited the great progress that had been made, the way in which Social Democratic Party had gained concessions, constitutional reforms, giving people the vote, a constantly increasing electorate. They already had 2 million votes then, which went up to 160 members of parliament, and very, very ample funds. It's considered by some informed writers that at one time the German Social Democratic Party, before the First World War, had over 40,000 paid officials on its payroll. It's been contended by people that the Social Democratic Party, with typical German thoroughness and organisational ability, that a member of the Social Democratic Party had his life thoroughly mapped out from Monday evening to Sunday evening. There was an organisation for everything. On Sunday he went out for a ramble with a Naturfreunde, the Friends of Nature. Then there were these gymnastic clubs for the Thursday. On the Tuesday it was the party meeting, and so on like this. But however that may be the case, there's no doubt that the party, the German Social Democratic Party, became very large and extremely influential. Now, Bernstein contended that there was no evidence that Marx's thesis of the centralisation of capital had actually materialised, that on the contrary, more workers were going up into what he called the middle class, instead of members of the capitalist class sinking down into the workers' ranks, and that all the concessions and all the advances which the trade unions had been able to make, and the very, very powerful and widespread cooperative movement in Germany, both producers and consumers cooperative movement, were all evidences of the fact that Marx was wrong, and as he said, the object is nothing, the movement is everything. And the idea was, and it was called revisionism, because the idea was that you were revising Marx's fundamental tenets or maxims. And the conclusion of all this was that what you did, you concentrated on the day-to-day struggle, and that therefore for this reason it was not necessary. Now, I will just, because I don't propose to go on all the hour, but and then one other thing, I'll come back to this question of the improvement of the conditions, and incidentally, this does have obvious, I mean, everybody sitting in this room, whether you agree or not, you know that we might as well be talking now. In fact, I'm going to read something from Rosa Luxemburg in reply to Bernstein, which I shall probably be saying with Harry Walters on the platform in Hyde Park tomorrow morning. It's just as apposite and up-to-date now, this minute, as it was when she wrote it 60 years ago. And now she at the age of about 28, she produced this amazing reply, which is not merely a striking refutation with all the facts. For instance, the one about shareholders. She said that he didn't understand what a capitalist was and what we meant by the fact about trade unions, which I'll come back to in a minute. But in addition to that, And this is one thing where we do have to be a little bit critical, but when it's Rosa Luxemburg, we can only be critical with kid gloves on in the gentlest possible fashion. And it was the fact that, and here again I would like to make a plea for her, because the German word, which Rosa and Eva will confirm for me, for collapse is Zusammenbruch. And all right, every American and every Englishman translates this word of Rosa Zusammenbruch into the literal meaning of our word for collapse of capitalism. But having said all that, you've got to face the facts and say that the conclusion that she drew from this, and explicitly stated too, was that capitalism would collapse. In fact, I'll read it to you. Bernd Skarstein began his revision of the social democracy by abandoning the theory of capitalist collapse. The latter, however, is the cornerstone of scientific socialism. Rejecting it, Bernstein also rejects the whole doctrine of socialism, and in the course of his discussion, he abandons one after another of the positions of socialism in order to be able to maintain his first affirmation. Now, I think a number of qualifying clauses have to be stuck onto this. It is true that the whole of the group with which she was associated, that is, of course, the ones who became known as Spartacus, and as far as we know, she was responsible for the choice of that name. You know, she became associated with Karl Liebknecht. That's Liebknecht's the original old grandfather daddy, the daddy of them all. And incidentally, while I'm on this, I might as well tell you that in connection with the war, and she made reference to this, and the 1914 war, the whole reputation of the German Social Democratic Party was built up for 40 years on Babel and Liebknecht's steadfast opposition to the German militarism and the German war, right from the days of the Paris Commune, and they both went to prison for it. And in those early days, as they said then, they were against a sea of enemies. But, of course, the reputation eventually gained ground and gained the German Social Democratic Party a tremendous worldwide reputation as an anti-militarist and anti-war party. Now, I was coming back to this where, so that you've got this situation where already in 1899, she produced this amazing book published under the title of Reform or Revolution in reply to the revisionist ideas of Bernstein, which was that there was no necessity for any revolution, that the normal progress of trade unions and cooperative societies and parliamentary reform would eventually bring the workers to there anyway, almost without noticing, and that, as he said, the movement is everything and the final goal is nothing. And this was the thing that Rosa Luxemburg seized on and insisted upon. And so that, in a way, Bernstein was standing for reform and therefore dropped the whole idea of any violent change, and therefore, in this she was right, logically he renounced any idea of the collapse of capitalism, which had always been a point in the outlook of these elements, the what you might call the orthodox Marxist elements, Mehring, Kautsky and others in the German Social Democratic Party. Incidentally, Kautsky was the editor and the high priest, the Dalai Lama, the Pope of Marxism in Germany, and he occupied this position because he too had been in London. Of course, he too had lived in Engels' house. He started life as a professional biologist and only became a political journalist or a Marxist publicist like that. He went back to Germany like the others and became the editor of the famous theoretical magazine of the German Social Democratic Party called... I'll think of it in a minute. Neue Zeit, oh blimey. Neue Zeit, meaning new time. And already She, at the age of about 25, was already making quite significant contributions to this and taking her place amongst all the venerable old granddaddies of Marxism in Germany, people like, and also, of course, Plekhanov was writing in it, and Bauer and other famous Marxists from other countries. But she wrote this reply, and the reply, of course, took the form, first of all, to pointing out the futility of abandoning the object and the class struggle and concentrating on reforms. And also coupled with that, she also did say that he had abandoned the idea of collapse, which was that the crises of capitalism would increase in magnitude and intensity until a stage would be reached when the workers would be forced to take action due to the difficulties of the situation. But I ought, in her interest, in common justice and fairness, I ought to say, she wrote this. This is already in 1899 in reply to Bernstein. What will be the immediate result should our party change its general procedure to suit a viewpoint that wants to emphasise the practical results of our struggle, that is, social reforms? As soon as these immediate results become the principal aim of our activity, the clear-cut, irreconcilable point of view, which has meaning only insofar as it proposes to win power, will be found to become more and more inconvenient. The direct consequence of this will be the adoption by the party of a policy of compensation, a policy of political trading, and an attitude of diffident diplomatic conciliation. But this attitude cannot be continued for a long time. Since the social reforms can only offer an empty promise, the logical consequence of such a programme must necessarily be disillusionment. Well, I think I'll go along with that. Also, she said, it is not true that socialism will arise automatically from the daily struggle of the working class. Socialism will be the consequence of, one, the growing contradictions of capitalist economy, and two, of the comprehension by the working class of the unavoidability of the suppression of these contradictions through a social transformation. When, in the manner of revisionism, the first is denied and the second rejected, the labour movement finds itself reduced to a simple cooperative and reformist movement. We move here in a straight line towards the total abandonment of the class viewpoint. Incidentally, when she dealt with trade unions, which of course I don't propose to go into in detail, but she did, she made one shattering analogy or reference which shows how clear and firm was her grasp of the Marxian economic proposition. She compared the successes and the great triumphs claimed by Bernstein for the trade union movement, which were the reason for dropping the objective of socialism and any revolutionary activity. She said this compares to the labours of Sisyphus. Well, Sisyphus was the mythological king of Corinth, who was sentenced by the gods for his sins to push a huge stone to the top of the hill. And you know what happened? When it got to the top of the hill, it rolled down again. So that we always quote the labours of Sisyphus as some endless, fruitless task, which as soon as you've finished, you start again. And she said, that's what the trade unions do. This, of course, completely enraged and drove the trade union leaders, as you can imagine, into hysterical, frantic opposition to her. They started calling her names and made offensive references. And at a trade union congress in Cologne in about 1908, they said, let Rosa Luxemburg babble what she likes. We'll get on with our practical work. Might as well be Lynn Murray, for all the difference it makes. So in addition to this, not merely did she refute the economic propositions that Bernstein was making and say that so far from the crises getting less, she produced figures to show that they were getting still deeper and still, apart from the theoretical mistake of imagining that they can be solved by this, in addition to dealing with the trade unions, well, she said on the one hand, trade unions have the function of influencing the situation in the labour market. Trade unions are nothing more than the organised defence of labour power against the attacks of profit. They express the resistance offered by the working class to the oppression of capitalist economy. On the other hand, trade unions have the function of influencing the situation in the labour power market, but this influence is being constantly overcome by the proletarianisation of the middle layers of our society, a process which continually brings new merchandise on the labour market. And the second function of the trade unions is to ameliorate the condition of the workers. That is, they attempt to increase the share of the social wealth going to the working class. But this share, however, is being reduced with the fatality of a natural process by the growth of the productivity of labour. One doesn't need to be a Marxist to notice this. In other words, the objective conditions of capitalist society transform the two economic functions of the trade unions into the sort of a labours of Sisyphus, who, nevertheless, is indispensable. For as a result of the activity of his trade unions, the worker succeeds in obtaining for himself the rate of wages due to him in accordance with the situation of the labour power market. As a result of trade union activity, the capitalist law of wages is applied, and the effect of the depressing tendency of economic development is paralysed, or to be more exact, is attenuated. At this time, even in those days, in 1904, 1903, and even earlier, the German trade unions were already discussing and commencing to implement certain forms of predetermination of rates of profit and output norms and things like that. And without going into the detail of this, you can read it up for yourself. She pointed out that as soon as workers do this, this is exactly the same as we're getting from the International Socialists and other people today about workers' control. As soon as you do this, all that you're doing is joining hands with the board of directors and the outfit, the undertaking, to predetermine the output and the rate of profit in competition with other workers and other countries. In other words, you've sold out and gone over to the other side with your workers' control and your agreement for a certain output norm, an industrial peace in order to maintain a certain price rate to make a profitable sale. Well, look, I better... Now, in addition to this, Rosa Luxemburg formulated a theory, and in no case that I know of is it true, as Marx said, that nobody can overlook the limits of their own environment, of their own world, the capitalist world in which we all live. And this was the time when there were tremendous mass strikes, for one thing in Belgium, 1.25 million were out, to strikes for what are called political ends, that is, strikes to constitutional reform, granting of the vote and things like this. And also, as you all know, 1905 was the outbreak of the first, what is usually termed the first stage of the Russian Revolution. It culminated in the granting of a number of constitutional reforms by the Tsar, and of course vitally affected not merely Russia but Russian Poland, which was Rosa Luxemburg's home ground, and her nationality, of course, although she acquired German nationality and actually only got into Germany by getting married to somebody who doesn't matter. We don't even remember his name anymore. It was a common German name, which she wanted. And as a result of this, she promptly hiked off back to Poland. She had been writing in the Polish illegal publications right from early girlhood, as Rosa already told you. And incidentally, one other interesting personal detail, which always sweetens the pill a little bit. She was, of course, involved in a marital relation with an extraordinary fellow, a chap. Well, he had so many illegal names that there was only a handful of people knew who he really was. He was a typical Eastern Revolutionary underground worker. This was the man by the name of Leo Jogiches, or sometimes known as Tisco, sometimes known as Tico, and he was the man behind the scenes who never appeared anywhere but fixed up the illegal print shops, supplied the money. Incidentally, like so many of these people, he was very well-bridged. He came from a very wealthy family, and he was the man with whom Rosa Luxemburg had a union lasting many years. When she eventually went to Germany, I don't know if I ought to tell you this, or you can read it for yourselves. Unfortunately, as we all do in the course of a long and active life, a number of unfortunate things happened. She broke with Leo and undertook a union with a rather silly and flighty boy half her age, but that we'll draw a veil over. That's of no real importance to our purpose. It's up to her to do what she liked. And one thing about Rosa that I liked, when she used to lock the door of her flat, she said, "That was it. I want my private life as well as my public life." And Rosa Luxemburg was a magnetic and charismatic personality who always had that ability, like people like Marx did with Helen de Moos. He had that ability to inspire, or whatever you like to call it, mesmerise or magnetise. And she always had a housekeeper who was like a tame tigress who made sure that Rosa had the privacy that she required for rest sometimes. So that she went back again to Poland, and so did... And one other thing I ought to tell you, there was, right from the earliest days, the Polish Socialist Party, and Rosa Luxemburg, to her great credit, and unlike Lenin, who followed exactly the opposite line, Rosa Luxemburg joined the Polish Social Democratic Party, which eventually became the Polish Social the Social Democratic Party of Poland and the Kingdom of Lithuania, because Lithuania was still a separate state but under Russian domination. And the Polish Socialist Party was the national party, the party that fought for national independence. And like all parties that fight for national independence, it finishes up in a war against all the others, like the African colonies and all the rest of them, now in our day. And Rosa Luxemburg was the one who consistently, with a handful of others, Marklevsky and Worski and people like this, who eventually most of them got back to Russia and joined the Bolshevik Party after 1917, they were the people who maintained, only a small handful of them, the Social Democratic Party of Poland, while a man by the name of Pilsudski, who you've all heard of, was the leading light in the Polish Socialist Party, which eventually became utterly nationalistic, fascist, and eventually was the party which raised the army to defeat the Red Army in its invasion of Poland in 1918. So that right from the very earliest days, 30 years previously, there was the cleavage between the Polish Socialist Party for national independence of Poland and the Polish Social Democratic Party, which, against the views of Lenin and all the others, the Bolsheviks in Russia, always took the view, she took the view, that whether Poland was under Russian domination or private Polish capitalist domination, the important point was the emancipation of the working class from capitalism and not fighting national wars of independence, which she also said in the Junius brochure, of course. Now, it was as a result of this that she got her first term of imprisonment. She was clapped into jail in Poland, but they managed to get her out on various pretexts. Incidentally, I think Rose told you that her family were quite prosperous. Her father was actually a timber exporter, and there's some branch, according to Nettle, this biographer of Rosa Luxemburg. By the way, I haven't got one of the best books. One of the best books was written by a man called Paul Froelich, who became subsequently a leading member of the Communist Party of Germany, and then, like so many others, broke with the Communist Party of Germany and became one of its severest critics. He wrote a very good, although somewhat sentimental and perhaps a little bit biased, but he was a Rosa Luxemburg devotee and fan. I'll tell you the reason why in a minute. She did 2 months in jail in Poland, eventually got back to Germany, and the next highlight was the International Socialist Congress, the famous one in Stuttgart in southern Germany, where Plekhanov and Katayama and Axelrod and, of course, Babel, Liebknecht, Kautsky, Adler from Germany, Ramsay MacDonald from England and the ILP, and incidentally also Harry Quilts from the Social Democratic Federation. And this was the famous meeting of the International Socialist Bureau, as it was called, where Harry Quilts called Carnegie had just given his money to form the Hague Convention to stop wars and build this palace, which is still there in The Hague in Holland. And Harry Quilts, so the SDF wasn't all bad. He denounced it as a thieves' kitchen. And this, the Germany was still divided up into local principalities. It was the province of Württemberg in those days, and they promptly expelled him and shot him back to England for being offensive. Incidentally, shortly after this, at a public meeting, Rosa Luxemburg received 3 months for making offensive remarks about the Kaiser. And That was her first prison sentence. She came out of prison and immediately became extremely active. Nobody, I can't tell you, I did have the benefit of listening to Clara Zetkin several times, but of course by the time I got to Germany, I was in Germany in 1918 and again in 1922, but I never had the good fortune to have the chance to hear. What she was like as an orator, there's not much has been said. What she's like as a writer, we know, but assuming, which I think is fairly reasonable, that if one can write, one can also speak. An ability to write, like I've just read out to you, as she wrote during the First World War, then she must have been an orator of considerable powers. No doubt about this. So whether she was or she wasn't, she was also an indefatigable dynamo of activity. And when I read a lot of this stuff now, it brings home to me very vividly what tremendous changes have taken place in our daily life and social customs, largely as a result of radio and particularly television. Because the more you read about this, Rosa Luxemburg now started off on a crusading campaign against the right wing of the German Social Democratic Party, which now had become pretty bad. They were stinking to high heaven, even before the 1914 war. And in spite of the things they were, people like Kautsky and others were still writing articles, but what they were doing was out of the question. And you can read cases where, you see, and the whole activities of the parties took place, particularly in Germany, where nobody can accuse the Germans of being short-winded or lost for words at any time. The only ones I've ever known exceed them at that game is Russians. But everything took place, and even in later years, every local organisation of the party had its meeting place, usually in a local Kneipe or beer hall, where endless discussions would take place. And during the latter time, even during the war, it's on record that she spoke at as many as 47 local party meetings in Berlin in 1 week. I mean, this is in addition. Now, while all this discussion was going on. Now, in 1908, she's already established a reputation as a writer. And in 1908, the German Social Democratic Party had ample funds, very large representation in the Reichstag, the parliamentary house, a great deal of support, and local papers were published and circulated quite successfully. Every big town had one, and as a result of her friendship with an extraordinary character named Parvus, who deserves an evening on his own. After being for a Russian emigre who was for years and years a publicist in Germany, as a result of the knowledge that he gained from studying people like Krupps and that, he went to Turkey and became a millionaire armaments importer. But anyway, Parvus was quite a character and quite a writer, and he was very friendly with being a Russian Pole, I think, and he invited her to contribute to the Leipziger Volkszeitung, and as a result of this, she started writing articles and was already opposing reformism. One other highlight of her career, most extraordinary case, at this time it was decided by the German Social Democratic Party that they would run a party school for the purpose of training what were called activists or officials or whatever you like to call them. And the idea was something along the same lines that we've got in Ruskin College here in England, or the National Council of Labour Colleges at one time. But the Social Democratic Party of Germany financed the whole thing. They paid all the expenses. They maintained about 30 or 35 students selected, you know, in the usual way for their aptitude or suitability, among whom, of course, was this Paul Frohlich, which probably accounts because everybody who became a student of Rosa Luxemburg immediately became a devotee and a lifelong disciple. Well, anyway, what I was going to tell you was, in 1911, I think I'm right in saying, this party school was established, and the job, the point then became, well, who was going to take charge? Who was going to run the outfit? And And various names were suggested. And don't forget, at this time, the German Social Democratic Party had a number of great figures in their own right. I mean, a man like Franz Mehring was an internationally qualified historian before he ever joined the Social Democratic Party. A number of very famous scientists and sociologists and people like this. Kautsky, of course. Now, Mehring at that time said that he was too old and too tired, because I think he was 70 then. Why he should be too old at 70, I can't think. But anyway, that's what he said. He didn't want the job. Kautsky was obviously in line. He wouldn't have it. And eventually somebody said, what about Rosa? And although she was always distinctly unpopular with the executive committee, for obvious reasons, who wouldn't be? A bloody pest like that who never let up. And they said eventually, all right, let Rosa take charge, which she did. And she was paid quite a good sum, about 3,500 marks, I think, for the session, the six-month session. And she flung herself into the job with her customary zeal and enthusiasm. It's been said that she frequently arrived home in the evening, having lectured all day and then taken private sessions with some promising student, young fellow or girl who's getting on in the party or somebody like that, completely and utterly exhausted. But and it was during this time that she considered, rightly or wrongly, that she'd found a discrepancy in volume two of Capital. She thought, and by the way, our old friend Tony Cliff has gone into this at some length, but I find when I read Tony Cliff's writings that I'm more confused at the end than I was when I started. But he's endeavoured to explain it, but his explanation to me cancels itself out. I'll just mention these points. If you want to ask anything about them, well, for Christ's sake, ask. She ran this party school. She thought she'd found this discrepancy in volume two of Capital, that Marx's proposition, that she says that in the second volume of Capital, Marx divides the productive apparatus into goods of production and goods of consumption, machinery and factories and electric stations and bread and butter and sugar and all the things we eat and consume, houses and that sort of thing, and that according to her, if we added up all the items that Marx lists under constant and variable capital and surplus value, if we add all those up in the first half and then I'll add them all up in the second half, they don't fit, that there's a discrepancy somewhere, that according to this theory, the workers must be producing more wealth in consumption departments than they are in production. Well, right or wrong, and I wouldn't care to go into it at the moment, I hope you will, but right or wrong, she, as a result of this, set about it and produced quite a lengthy volume, which is considered to be one of, outside of Marx and Engels themselves, one of the most significant contributions that's ever been written, called The Accumulation of Capital. Several savants and sages and know-alls had a go at this. Otto Bauer tried his hand at it. Hilferding wrote a huge volume on it. And of course it was from this that Lenin and then Bukharin, partly from J.A. Hobson, but also from Hilferding and from Bauer and from Rosa Luxemburg, that Lenin contrived his theory of imperialism. And the bribed and pampered workers in the metropolitan capitalist state waxing fat on the super profits of the half-starved coolies of India and China and Africa and all that sort of thing. You see that? So the accumulation of capital. Now, I better cut this short, and I'm coming now for us, the most interesting part, certainly the most dramatic part of it all. Well, of course, you all know, and Rose has told you, and we're going to assume that you know, when 1914 came, despite the fact that they enjoyed the reputation of being an anti-war party, despite the fact that the founders of the party, August Bebel and Wilhelm Liebknecht, had gone to jail, been jailed in a fortress for refusing to vote for war credits, and denounced and called on the German workers to unite with the revolutionary workers in Paris, in the Paris Commune, despite all that, and a declaration 2 days before the actual declaration of war on Germany by Great Britain and the invasion of Belgium, the German Social Democratic Party, on the actual fateful day, as you know, decided to vote for the war credits on the grounds that, first of all, above all, German culture and literature and knowledge had got to be protected from the barbarian Russians and the black hand of the Tsar. that always even Marx, and this, by the way, they were right in this. Marx, of course, was a fanatical, frantic Russophobe. And I don't blame him. Marx was always screaming for war on Russia. And where was some? He said the black hand of the Russian Chancellery is in every government in Europe, and it was. I'm laughing about this. This was done, and immediately this was done. Of course, the reaction of people like Luxembourg was the one solitary figure, as we all know today. Although I was rather surprised. I mean, it's always something you can learn in reading the biography by Nettle, the American, the English professor. By the way, poor bloke was killed in a plane crash. Quite good, quite good, quite reasonable and sympathetic. Already in by 1915. About 9 months after the outbreak of the war, 15 Social Democrat deputies in the Reichstag already were voting against the war credits, and by 1916, 44. But of course, in the meantime, all sorts of things are taking place. The first thing was Rosa Luxemburg, from prison, where she'd already been clapped as soon as the war started, had written this. That's the first thing. The next thing was a man by the name of Karl Liebknecht, who's an extraordinary character. He was the son of the famous Wilhelm Liebknecht. Wilhelm was the man who wrote the stories about Karl Marx on Sunday morning on Hampstead Heath. He went back to Germany, became the leader of the Social Democratic Party, and his son, Karl, was trained as a lawyer, and Karl stood up alone in the Reichstag and voted against the war credits and demanded that, shouted down with the war and denounced it and so on. The first thing they did, and they could do this under German conditions, was to clap him in uniform by force and send him to the front. After he'd been at the front a few months, they saw how bloody silly that was, and they promptly brought him back again. So the next thing is, and clapped him into jail, where he's less dangerous than at the front. The next thing, by being clapped into jail, according to German constitutional law, first of all, he lost his barrister's qualification. They don't have civil, they have just barristers. He lost his legal qualification. Secondly, he would be deprived of all political rights. He lost his membership of the Reichstag. He went back to the meeting, and the Social Democrats, the members of his own party, were shouting, "Madman, chuck him out," and all this sort of stuff. Much worse than the right wing. And it was from this that he went straight to the Potsdamer Platz, which we might say, what would we say, Trafalgar Square? Piccadilly Circus. And by this time, Franz Mehring, the great historian, the man who wrote The Life of Karl Marx, Clarence Etkin, who I did hear many times in Moscow, Liebknecht himself, and of course Rosa Luxemburg, they had by this time formed what they called the Spartacus Group, taking its name from the legendary leader of the famous slave revolts in Rome, you know, the man who assembled an army of thousands, 40 or 50,000 slaves, and made war on Rome for many years before he was finally exterminated, decimated. And they called it Spartacus Group. And Liebknecht went to the Potsdamer Platz and stood up on a stool or something and shouted down. Of course, they were all waiting for him. And no sooner had he got a few words out of his mouth, "Down, I denounce the imperialist capitalist war," than he was grabbed and hustled off and slung straight inside. However, obviously, by what took place afterwards, the German struck. It was there, the seed was there, and from that day on the anti-war movement grew steadily in Germany, and of course had a great deal to do, not entirely. I mean, I'm not contending that the Allies didn't win the war, of course they did militarily, by American support, but there's no doubt that the rot had set in by this time in Germany, and as is always the case, the longer wars go on, the more dissatisfied the people get. In Germany, they were promised, like they always are everywhere, that it would be over in 4 weeks, not 4 years. Incidentally, in this book, long before the end of the war came, she devoted two chapters. One, she says, suppose Germany wins the war, what will happen? And suppose it loses the war, what will happen? Went into the greatest detail and predicted exactly what would happen, and coming, of course, to the correct conclusion that we've always held, it wouldn't make any difference whether they won or whether they lost in the long run. And taking it from both sides, what would happen if France and Britain won the war, and so on. Magnificent piece of writing. And as a result of this, by this time, She was out of prison again. Then eventually abdication of the Kaiser came with a final military defeat in the field. The Kaiser, he was quick enough to see that the best thing he could do was to hop off, so he very kindly gave Germany to the German people, taking jolly good care that a few million marks had been carefully salted away in Holland before he did it, and then went and lived to a ripe old age of 84, chopping down trees somewhere in Holland. Well, by this time, 1918... the whole state of the German economy, of course, was in a state of breakdown. And it's all very well to talk about capitalism will not collapse, but I want to put a word in for Rosa Luxemburg. I was in Germany in 1922, and capitalism had bloody well collapsed. Make no mistake about it. People were running around with little things asking to change a piece of something for a piece of bread. People were coming out of factories and places, bank clerks coming home with their wages on a little trolley. Somebody showed me a postage stamp. 2 million marks! I mean, but what we've always contended is we didn't say that German capitalism couldn't collapse, or for that matter, English or American, but the capitalist system will never collapse so long as the workers support it. So from that point of view, maybe we can put in a plea for Rosa Luxemburg. Now, one last thing that I must say. Oh, perhaps I ought to tell you something else that Rose didn't tell you. I know you might be thinking this. What was she like? Well, for one thing, she was very tiny. These firebrands always are, aren't they? And she was a little bit self-conscious about this. In the first fine careless rapture, the first flush of her affair with Leo, she wrote very touching letters to him. And that's another thing, you see. So much of our life today goes on the telephone and teleprinters and all this, but the number of letters, I mean, they used to, Christ, they must have sat up all night writing bloody letters. I don't know, they did it all by hand. And she wrote very, very pathetic and touching letters to Leo, saying that she was sorry that she was so small and that he hadn't got a beautiful wife and she was so ugly. Well, I mean, not even the most fanatical Rosa Luxemburg fan could contend that she was a beauty. But she was small. She had a rather unprepossessing countenance, we might say. And also, from early age, she'd had a touch of hip disease, and she walked with a most unfortunate limp. And when you think of this little tiny scrap, less than 5 foot tall, taking on the entire Social Democratic Party and rushing round and doing 40 meetings a week, demolishing, she scraped them right off when she had a go at them, and I agree with Rose. I don't care what members of the party say, in this case you are dealing with a fantastic personality. And somebody who merits, in my view, the appreciation in their own right for their personal qualifications. One last thing I've got to tell you, and that is, of course, about the Russian Revolution. Now, unfortunately, and we've said this in the Socialist Standard, and the article that appeared in the Socialist Standard was very sound, quite all right. The criticism was reasonable, and of course she did say, and I suppose she had to say in the circumstances, the masses are ready to support any revolutionary action. They're ready to go through fire and water for socialism. The Spartacus called on the German workers to revolt. A number of them got out their old guns that they probably come home with from the war. And one thing they were very clever at doing, this is an idea I recommend to the SPGB, they marched over to the head office of the publication, the printing works of Forwets, and took the number that was on the presses and said, chuck that rubbish away and you're going to print this, the Rota Fana, which it did. Of course, I do imagine the executive committee of the SDF wasn't very pleased about that. There they are outside doing it. They've taken control of the party's printing works. Because you must remember this, that right from our earliest days, and this, whether this was right or wrong, you've got to make up your mind for yourselves, but she always took the line that at all costs, and I mean we've met people like this in England, don't we? At all costs, you've got to stick inside the Social Democratic Party. Whatever it did, if you leave it, you know, we've all heard this, you'll cut yourself off from the masses. And when one of her closest friends wrote and said she couldn't stick it any longer, it made her sick to think about it, and she was going to pack it up. She begged her not to do it and all the rest of it. I would think that a person in Rosa's position could see that she would lose all the facilities and the opportunity that, although, incidentally, when the Workers and Soldiers Councils were formed, they refused the nomination of both Karl Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg on the grounds that neither of them were workers or soldiers. which of course by that time Liebknecht wasn't. He was a deserter and all the rest of it. But when it came to the Russian Revolution, she did take part in the formation of the Russian, the German Communist Party. I ought to have mentioned, sad oversight on my part, in 1916 already, the position had got so bad with the Social Democratic Party of Germany supporting the war, that a group of them, Karpsky, a centrist they were called, Karpsky, Hugo Haase, and a number of others, Legion, people like that, I can't call to mind at the moment, you can always easily look them up, they formed the Independent Socialist Party, Independent Social Democratic Party, which was a breakaway and which occupied an anti-war position but refused to go to the revolutionary lengths of the Spartacus group. And the Spartacus group, the members of it were still nominally members of the, although they would have liked to have chucked them out, but they couldn't find any grounds, they would like to chuck Rosa out of the Social Democratic Party. She was still a member formally of the Social Democratic Party, Spartacus group, and they had a sort of an agreement and steadfastly refused. Liebknecht refused to accept any proffers of government posts and all the sorts of things which the Independent Socialist Party thought that they would succeed to have when they had taken over, which they hoped to do. Well, eventually, as you know, 1917, the Russian Revolution broke out. This exerted an immense influence on the German business, particularly as the Russians were relying on the Germans. I mean, it's difficult for us in our day to realise the immense prestige and influence of the Germans. It was the heart and the backbone and the living brain. It supplied all the Karpskys and the Mehrings and the writers and the orators and the money and the they subsidised the Russian party with money. All these little local papers, they discovered that one of them, that so I think Rosa was editing for one time, they worked out it was costing 35 marks a copy. About 20 workers were buying it, you know, in a provincial town somewhere. Well, I mean, we know something about that, don't we? And so that right from, I ought to read you this bit, because right from the start off, whether she supported collapse theories or not, whether she pinned her faith in these mass strikes, which she did, she said that the workers will learn through these mass political strikes, they will learn the facts of capitalism and rapidly, and to a certain extent, what's called a theory of spontaneity, that spontaneously, without any necessarily protracted mental education, that the workers in mass would learn in millions the right step to take. And always, of course, unfortunately, linked up with the leadership idea. But she said, this is what Spartacus stands for. And as usual, she wrote all the declarations of principles, or whatever you like to call them, Spartacus will refuse to accept power merely because Scheidemann and Ebert have gone bankrupt and because the independents, that's the centre party, find themselves in a blind alley as a result of their cooperation with them. I'd like you to listen to this bit. Spartacus will never undertake to govern other than through the clear and unmistakable wish of the great majority of the proletarian masses of Germany, and never without their conscious agreement with the ideas, aims, and methods of Spartacus. Government by the proletariat can only battle its way to complete clarity and readiness, step by step, through a long valley of sorrows, of bitter experience, of defeats and victories. The victory of Spartacus is not at the beginning, but at the end of the revolution. It is the same as the victory of the great masses of the socialist proletariat. Now, when it came to the actual foundation of the Communist Party of Germany, which now was largely this independent party, a part of that broke away and joined up. Many emissaries of the Russians were there. Radek had already been there. Radek was an extraordinary character. Radek was a Polish Jew who for many years had been operating in Germany. Actually, he was under a bit of a cloud. He was actually accused of pinching money from one of the papers that he was helping to edit. But anyway, he was in Berlin at the time. Bukharin was there, sent by Lenin. And when they heard that under these circumstances, Liebknecht and Luxembourg were going to call on the workers to revolt, they immediately concluded how utterly absurd it would be. They had sufficient experience of this lark to know what would happen. And what would happen was this. Actually, the workers' and soldiers' councils, completely dominated by the Social Democratic Party of Germany, and supporting people like Ebert, didn't have the slightest reluctance to gun the Spartacists down, and the whole thing was over in a matter of 48 hours. But as a result of this and the discussions that took place, although Rosa Luxemburg joined the and took a leading part and made one of the leading speeches in the foundation of the German Communist Party, she wrote to say on the Russian Revolution, wrote pamphlets on the, and she said, Lenin is completely mistaken in the means he employs. Decrees and dictatorial force of the factory overseer, draconic penalties and rule by terror, all these things are but mere palliation. The only way to rebirth is the school of public life itself, the most unlimited, the broadest democracy and public opinion. It is rule by terror which demoralises. And she went on to say that if you go on in this way in Russia, you'll, and nobody could have been more prophetic in this case, she said you'll have rule behind desks by a gang of bureaucrats who are feathering their own nests and demoralising and silencing the voice of the very people who have got to be heard if any progress is going to be made. And with the repression, this is the way she wrote about Lenin in Russia, with the repression of political life in the land as a whole, life in the Soviets, how prophetic this is, shades of Solzhenitsyn, life in the Soviets must also become more crippled. Life dies out of every public institution and becomes a mere semblance of life in which only the bureaucracy remains the active element. Public life gradually falls asleep. The few dozen party leaders of inexhaustible energy and boundless experience direct and rule. Among them, only a dozen outstanding heads do the leading, and an elite of the working class is invited from time to time to meetings where they are to applaud the speeches of the leaders and to approve the proposed resolutions unanimously. At bottom, merely a clique affair, a dictatorship to be sure. Not the dictatorship of the proletariat, however, but only a dictatorship of a handful of politicians in the bourgeois sense. Yes, we go even further, she said. Such conditions can only cause a brutalisation of public life. Well, now, you've heard something about Rosa Luxemburg, and I stand here before you as an unrepentant, fully committed fan of Rosa's. I think that in many respects we can explain, like we could, some of the things that Marx said and did that we disagree with today on the grounds of the circumstances in which she lived. And after all that we've said about, and all we've criticised, as we can all do, about some of her mistakes and some of the fallacies, when you've subtracted all that, you can only say that in Rosa Luxemburg, the working class threw up a fantastic, gifted personality, a genius of a writer, a great orator, and above all, an indefatigable fighter for socialism, one who showed the whole world how to stand up alone against a sea of opponents and enemies. And I'm not afraid to say that her name, as Marx said about the communards, he said, their names will be enshrined forever in the great heart of the working class. And I think if we can say tonight, Rosa Luxemburg paid for her life with her fight for her principles, but we can say tonight that in our hearts she's enshrined also. May Rosa Luxemburg's name live in the hearts and minds of socialists forever.